wondering what you want to be when you grow up? Have you wondered how to get into a certain line of work and never known where to start? My name is John Manigon. I'm a career fly-in, fly-out worker, working as an electrical instrumentation technician in all aspects of heavy industry, including mining and oil and gas, in Australia and abroad. Given my limited exposure to other industries, I've always wondered what exactly do people do when they go to work. Tune in as we discuss from the mundane to the mind-blowing, and everywhere in between, where we garner insight from real industry professionals living the job. What better place to go for first-hand career advice? So if you're a school leaver or a concerned parent of a school leaver looking for some direction, or perhaps you're having a midlife crisis and looking for a career change, you've come to the right place. Welcome, classmates, to the working class. On today's podcast, I'm talking to Matt Templeton. Matt was a naval officer. He now continues working with the military as a reservist and a contracting consultant, in addition to running his own business. Listen in and hear how not having any idea what he wanted to do after leaving school led him to a successful career in the Navy, and how those skills keep him gainfully employed outside of the military. Let's get started. Welcome, Matt Templeton. Thanks for coming, mate.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, mate. So you're a Navy man, or you were a Navy man?
Yeah, that's right. Navy was my first career, and then defense industries, really, or things associated with defense, have really been what's kept me busy for the other half of my so far working life. Mm. But yeah, the first 10 years full-time Navy.
Just a question about that. I mean, I've got a note here that you finished high school.
Yep.
And then you went straight into the Navy.
Yep.
How did you make that decision?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question.
Is it the uniforms?
No, probably not. They were different back then. Right. The uniforms have changed, I think, about four times since I joined. So both my parents were associated with the Army. My dad was sort of a career Army reservist, if you can have such a thing. And my mum was also in the Army, so sort of defence was in my sort of background. Mm. But how I ended up joining the Navy, I really can't stitch those pieces together. I do remember mum and dad sort of inviting, you know, some of their friends over who were, you know, naval officers or people associated with the Navy. Have some sort of memories of, you know, going past Garden Island in Sydney and looking at Navy ships and thinking they look pretty good. But then how I actually made that jump to signing up and joining at 17 and a bit. I think I just didn't apply for university and then told people that I was joining the Navy. So I sort of had to follow through with it. Yeah, just sort of backed myself into a corner.
Right.
And
you had to.
And then there I was, yeah. Yeah. And you know, mum and dad probably were getting ready to sell my bed or something like that.
When you say they were career reservists, they had other jobs?
Yeah, so more so dad was career reservist, so long-term career in the Army as a reservist. He ended up commanding one of the battalions out of Sydney and doing some, you know, various deployments and things like that. Mum went to Bougainville. You know, you'd be familiar with that part of the world. She did a deployment over there with the peacekeeping forces. So there was certainly military in my background. I'm the only sort of one in my family or generation that's gone into defence. Mm-hmm. All my cousins and siblings and things like that are not in that in that line of work. So it's just what I ended up with doing, and it sort of seems to have suited me.
Yeah. Well, that's a good thing. So you were only applied at the Navy, or did you think Army might be a good fit for you, or Air Force, or?
Yeah, I think I actually started talking Army because that's what I was familiar with through mum and dad. Although I don't remember it, I think They did steer me away from it. They probably knew the type of person I was, and probably what I wouldn't want to put up with.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly now that I know what Army does, what Navy does, what the Air Force does, I'm much more inclined to have probably gone with the Navy. I like my creature comforts a little bit. I don't mind doing hard work, but I do like a warm bed that's my own and a hot shower and a couple of hot meals. Whereas, you know, I think the Army guys, you know, they literally go camping every weekend, and that that can be a little rough for me. I like my creature comforts. So I don't know if how much influence my parents did there, whether it was subliminal or what, but at some point I just started thinking, I'm going to be a naval officer. That sounds awesome. Mm. You know, bridge of a destroyer in the North Atlantic. How good would that be?
And where did you go to high school?
Canberra.
Canberra.
So I started my schooling life out in central West New South Wales, so mm-hmm. Dubbo and Cobar,
right.
On sort of smallish farms comparatively. And then moved to Canberra for year six, and then did year six, all of high school, college in Canberra, and then, you know, finished high school in, you know, December, whatever year it was, 2021, no, not that, 2001, out by 20 years. and then 6 weeks later, down at HMAS Creswell in Jarvis Bay, learning to be a naval officer.
What sort of a student were you in high school?
Probably a lazy one, I think is probably the best way to say that. So I was, I'm a sort of a math, science, outdoor sort of person.
Yeah.
Less so English or the social sciences or biology and things like that. So just
less the arts.
Yeah, less the arts, definitely. Mm. Definitely more, you know, something that has a firm answer.
Mm-hmm.
So maths and science. Although certainly through sort of year 9, year 10, certainly wasn't at the top of my game in maths and science, and sort of realised that I'm not always going to be an A-grade student. I'm going to have to be comfortable being a B-grade student, which was fine. So then going into college, just stuck with physics, chemistry.
I wouldn't ask you to judge a poetry competition.
Maybe now you could. certainly my later careers have moved more into the better use of English, good use of English. Certainly as a kid, you know, I wasn't reading books. I wasn't interested in that. I wanted to be out running around in the paddock and understanding how machines worked and, figuring out maths and stuff. So, after high school, probably became more interested in reading, more interested in understanding things about the arts and more social sort of stuff. I got through year 11 and 12 by doing the sort of the bare minimum that you needed to do. So what will get me into university and get me into a Bachelor of Science or something like that. Yeah. But did enjoy some aspects of English more as I got a little bit older. So year 12, I had a couple of really good English courses. I spent probably most of my time in year 11 and 12 going rock climbing and canyoning and outdoor stuff. So
you'd agree that you probably didn't apply yourself very well in high school?
Oh, definitely not.
Yeah.
Definitely not. Definitely just wanted to get through and then get out the other side and get into the
world. I think you
workforce.
And I are very similar in that regard. Like I kind of, was not into. Well, things kind of came easy to me. Like, I'm not saying I was the smartest person in the room, but, you know, I got mediocre results with little effort, if you will.
I'd put myself in that category. I think if I'd I think if I'd worked a lot harder, I could have achieved a lot more, but I sort of wanted to enjoy myself a fair bit as well. Did whatever schooling I needed to do, went and had a casual job on the side to earn money to then go and spend that money on fuel and rock climbing equipment and camping equipment.
So what was that job?
Oh, I worked in an irrigation shop. So, selling sprinklers and 90 mil poly pipe. So
getting to know your thread sizes and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, you know, so metrics, imperials. Yeah, you know, can I fit brass to this and that, and all the good stuff. So that was an enjoyable sort of job. It was a little bit practical in a sense of, you know, someone would come in and ask a question about how they were gonna water their grass, and you'd whip out, draw a quick thing and measure out some how much poly they might need and how many T-joints and how they're going to plug it into the mains and, you know, try and sell them a big water controller with solenoids. Yeah, really, really good fun.
Didn't inspire you to pursue a career in irrigation then?
No.
You had bigger plans.
No, I just thought digging trenches was going to be a real bore after a while. Right. So, excuse the pun, of course. It was definitely a job to earn money to then spend that money as a kid. So which was great, and I had two mates who worked there as well. So we all just cashed up and then went and spent all that money on like I said, going camping or fuel to get us down to Point Perpendicular to go climbing for a weekend or something. So
do you still climb now?
No, I probably haven't climbed in 20 years.
Right. So you don't miss it then.
I wish it was something I had kept up. You know, the same as probably learning an instrument and things like that. But it's one of those things that now it's been so long, I think it would be a completely different experience going back to it as a, you know, near 40-year-old as opposed to a 16-year-old. Yeah, wish I'd kept it up, but no, life took me in another direction. There's not many good rock climbing cliffs at sea.
No.
and you need people. That was the main thing, is that you need to really enjoy it, you needed a good team, a good climbing
people
partner.
You trust, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, someone about your level, maybe a little bit better in some aspects to challenge you. Once I'd sort of packed my bags and, you know, joined the Navy.
Yeah.
You know, you became very focused on that career for a long time. So syncing back up with the climbing guys and finding time to go climbing and
then people have families and then
absolutely,
you know, and their own interests. It's
mention that your you know, your fitness drops away really quickly. Not that I was a great climber, I was good enough, but
there's certain muscle groups that only climbers use, right?
Yeah.
And dexterity and flexibility and all the rest. Yeah,
that's it. So, but you know, when you're getting up at, you know, 4:30 in the morning and doing all the Navy stuff, and then, you know, the time on the weekend isn't the highest priority in your mind to go climbing on a weekend or go hiking. It's generally to sleep or other things.
Yeah. Can you just you know, from what you remember, talk us briefly about the whole application process for joining the Navy? I mean, I've seen these Navy officers, not officers, Navy shop fronts, if you will, around town.
Yep.
To limit the confusion, and I often wonder how many people just walk in there off the street. And were you one of those guys, or did you take a different route?
No, so I think if I remember correctly, it was you know, the centre of Canberra there, whatever that is, probably called the Canberra Centre, I think it is. And there was a recruiting office there, and I think I just walked in and talked to a guy in a white uniform and thought, geez, that's pretty impressive, and got all the details. Found out, you know, a couple of years later that was like a junior sailor who, you know, good blokes and things like that, but probably not someone who really could tell me a lot about what the future of a naval officer's career might be. So, you know, slight lesson there of, you know, make sure you talk to the right people.
Yeah, but those guys are put in those roles for certain reasons, I would have thought.
More so just to vet and to, I think to, you know, make sure that we're coming in for the right reason. But, I don't actually really remember talking to an actual, you know, someone who might be 5-10 years ahead in my career until quite late in the process, probably sort of like the final interviews. From what I remember, I think I just walked in off the street, sort of said, oh, I was thinking about joining. I was probably barely 17 then, so sort of, you know, halfway through year 12.
And you joined and you were under 18, is that correct?
Yeah.
Is that still a thing they do now, or do you have to wait till you're 18?
No, I think there's still a lot of under 18s coming in.
Is that right?
Probably, well, probably as much on both sides of the non-commissioned ranks. So your sailors, your soldiers, your aviators, I think they're now called, and on your officer side. So when Navy has an intake of officers, I was in the January intake. There's two a year, or there was when I joined. Mm. And about half of us were what we call direct entries. So basically we're coming in, we'd do our training, 6 months sort of learning how the Navy works, and then we'll straight out into the fleet, get to work, learning your trade effectively.
So when you show up, do they ask you, you know, are there options within the Navy? Like, you, what are you interested in? Is that a question they ask you?
Or? Yeah, definitely. Right. You know, whether or not you want to go and get a degree or if you have a degree.
Mm.
So if you're, so the other half, I'll just circle back, the other half of the intake are the people, again, sort of, you know, 17, 18, who are then going to go to the Defence Force Academy and get a degree from Uni of New South Wales, but paid for by Defence. So it's a, you know, you do a 4-year degree, you owe Defence, you know, 5 years service afterwards. So it's a bit of a quid pro quo type arrangement.
Of course.
I came in and they said, oh, do you want to go to uni? You want to get a degree? And I said, no, I'm joining the Navy because I don't want to go to uni. I want to get out there and be a man and
get
stuff.
Get my hands dirty.
Yeah. so that obviously immediately limited me. I couldn't be an engineer because I didn't have any sort of technical degree or training. And so straight away I sort of became the options of becoming a warfare officer, a supply officer, so logistics. If I had any competence in flying aircraft, I might have been able to become an aviator or something like that. But I basically went the traditional, or sort of the probably most well-known path, which is like, okay, how do I end up commanding a ship in the future? How do I be like admiral of the fleet? So that's the warfare officer path, and effectively, I would say it's a trade, that you learn on the job, you do a whole lot of theory, then you go out and you practice it, and you go through incremental stages of, you know, being able to handle a ship, in sort of its own company. So, you know, basically just driving around in the ocean, and then, doing, you know, fast near shore passages, so more complex navigation, and then you slowly step up until you've sort of, you know, driving a ship as part of a fleet of ships all zigzagging around, having a fat time, you know, throwing missiles at aircraft and stuff. So and you know, that's about a two to three year process to step through all of that. So I took that path, and yeah, it was really driven by, you know, one, I don't have a degree, I didn't want to get a degree at the time. I didn't really feel that things like logistics were really my path. I sort of wanted to be in the action. And, you know, warfare officers were called seaman officers back then. But, you know, it's in the name, you know, warfare, great.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
You know, it's all the guns are blazing and things like that. And, yeah, quite a diverse job in the end. So a lot of which I found out on the fly what my job actually was.
Right. So. you annex the word officer to pretty much all of those roles you described there. Is that, I mean, is there a segregation between officers and non-officers, I guess?
Yeah, definitely. So it's a hierarchical organization.
Okay.
And you basically, you've got your I'll say at the bottom, but, I temper that by saying that doesn't mean they're you know, the lower class or anything like that. It's just the way the organization's structured. So at the bottom, you've got your other ranks. So in Navy terms, you know, your seamen and your able seamen. So they're the workers. You know, the guys and girls hauling on lines, operating computers, you know, driving boats, you know, all the really good fun stuff. So the really, you know, the active members of the ship and the fleet. And then you step up from them, you go to your non-commissioned officers. So they're sort of like your supervisors and your managers. So they're the ones sort of, you know, you might have one leading seaman, you know, supervising 15 able seamen and seamen, getting something done, getting a part of ship painted or launching a boat or managing a watch of engineers. And then you progressively step up through those until you get to your petty officers, chief petty officers, warrant officers, at least in the Navy side. And then there's a slide across to where you enter your commissioned ranks, which are technically the officers, which in the Navy terminology starts at midshipman and goes all the way up to admiral. And it's certainly in the senior non-commissioned ranks, so your petty officers and your chief petty officers, and your junior commissioned ranks, there's a really lot of crossover there. So, as a young sub-lieutenant, you might be responsible or in charge of, for lack of a better word, a bunch of chiefs and petty officers, but, those guys have got 20, 30, 40 years of experience behind them. So it's that balance between management and leadership, and sort of knowing your place, and that you might be in charge, but it doesn't mean that you're
so ranks, not everything is what you're saying.
Absolutely.
I'm guessing, ships as big as they are still pretty small communities.
I certainly would have done this, guaranteed. If you got the sailors or the senior sailors offside, your life was going to get difficult.
Right.
Not in a sort of, nasty way, but they'd stop helping you.
Yeah. It's going to be harder than what it needs to be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas if they like you and they can see you trying hard, and then they'll do things to help you. They'll whisper over your shoulder, you might want to do this before the boss sees you. Oh yeah, geez, didn't think about that. And, or they'll stop you doing something really silly. They'll put their hand on your shoulder and say, you definitely don't want to do that. And
so, I spoke to a US military pilot recently, and I guess one of his lessons was don't be a dick.
And it's a pretty good lesson. Really hard to do, actually.
Right.
I think when I go back and look at it, the structure is there that they don't necessarily enforce that or don't really reinforce it. Sorry, that hey, we're all human. You've got a job to do. They've got a job to do.
Yeah.
This is not, 1750s England where there's, lower, middle, upper classes and gentry and stuff like that, and some of that, esprit de corps sort of within like an officer community sometimes doesn't sort of necessarily control those aspects of how people act. So you got to keep an eye on it. And I certainly say that I was definitely a dick at some point in my career, probably several times.
You got a bit of dickishness within you then.
Oh, I think continuously. And I think it's that constant battle within myself to sort of go, okay, how do you do this while still being a good bloke?
Right.
Like, how do you, and that balance between being authoritative and saying, no, look, my job is to direct this to happen and I'm going to make it happen. But then also, and dealing with that at the instant that it has to happen. But then also, just being nice to people and being friendly and sort of saying, hey, sorry, I had to, tear shreds off your back there. But if you didn't do what I said, we could have had a big accident. No hard feelings. We're all mates. Let's get on with it. So that's taken, I would say, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years to really sort of understand that balance and how to control that and how to, an old friend of mine said it really well, how to be like a relaxed professional. So just sort of like, we all know what we're doing, but there's a structure here.
And micromanagement is, I guess, not a great way to manage people.
It's an evil thing, and it's easy to fall into.
Right.
You've got to let people learn and fail. And watching, sitting back and watching somebody fail is a really hard thing to do. But that's actually a really good way to let people learn.
Did you observe peers like on your level, even above you, that you could see were failing in that regard, and you feel for them, but do you, it's difficult to broach that issue with people, I'm guessing. Would you just let them fail or say, well,
the
guys are,
I think
the guys are revolting.
Yeah. I think it sort of depends. If you care about the individuals, or you care about who they're leading or who they're managing, you sort of want to prevent that happening too bad. Like, mm-hmm. I've certainly been there and watched, my comrades trying to do a navigation passage or do some sort of warfare serial, and it just everything falling apart, and them just getting flustered and frustrated, and nothing working. And of course, that's the exact time when the commanding officer or the principal warfare officer start to apply that little bit of extra pressure, just to see, let's see where this goes.
Right.
And you're just sitting back there, and you really want to step in, because you're in the privileged position of being an observer. And you go, if I could just jump in now, I could, get that done and might take some pressure off them. But you just know that, that's not the way to help them. Probably the better way to help them is afterwards, just go down the mess and have sit down and just go, oh man, like, yeah, I wouldn't have done any better. And, and just be someone like that. And, remind them that it's just a job. No one died.
Right.
And 99% of what we were doing out there was just training. So practicing, so that if the one day where the event actually happened, maybe people would go, well, that wasn't as bad as that training we did.
Did you, in saying that, and I noticed that even in the industry where I work, where people or society will, dictate that you need to strive to climb a ladder or a corporate ladder and get better, and, well, not so much get better, but reach a higher level within an organization. Yet, the observation that maybe those people are happy where they are and kind of forcing them into a position, and then they're not provided with any leadership training or any way to cope, and then they end up going from, say, a really good engineer to a really mediocre people manager. Did the Navy kind of offer that? Did they, within your progression throughout the Navy, was there such training that allowed you to kind of grow as a leader?
I think it's sort of hard to say, because I think it's also that my, obviously I was a young man, the perspective on what I thought leadership was and management was versus probably what I think of it now. A bit of a hard one to answer. I would say, yes, they tried. How much that proper learning space was provided and how much you got to practice it. I think ultimately what it came down to was who your supervisors were and who your mentors were. If you had a really good boss and a really good couple of senior guys around you, or even some of your peers who might have been 10, 15 years older than me, I joined with a lot of 35 and 40 year olds who brought some real life with them, and they'd temper the enthusiasm of a 18 year old. So I think that's where the real training happened on how to manage people, how to lead, how to make good decisions, how to make timely decisions. I think if you ended up with the wrong bunch of people, and the wrong sort of mentality and the wrong culture, you could go well off the rails really, really quickly.
And then end up hating what you do.
And it's not
something the Navy wants to promote. I'm guessing they want to keep the people they train in the job as long as they can. Yeah.
Yeah. Retention is their big driver. Once you've put a couple of years of training into somebody, they're a really valuable asset. So they want to hang on to them. Yeah, there's certainly. I mean, leadership and management are really complex issues, particularly in a defense environment. And I certainly wouldn't, protest to be an expert in sort of either. But like I said, I think it's probably took me 15 years to sort of figure out what my style was.
And that's what I found. A lot of the time, leadership training kind of consists of just being on the job and doing the job. And I wonder how much, I've sat in a couple of leadership courses myself, and it's always tough to book learn something without practicing it.
Yeah.
You know, and you wonder one of the benefits of it. And like you say, having positive mentors and having people who are good at leadership.
Mm. Or really, really bad at it. They're equally good. I've had a couple of shocking people, I would say, leading me or managing me. And I keep those guys in the back of my head and think, God, I never want anyone to say, remember when that Templeton bloke bloody was doing this? Geez, I never want to be like Templeton. I sort of go, I want to take that as a lesson. So,
yeah.
Yeah, much prefer to positive mentors. They're much more happy. But I tell you what, some of the negative ones really stick in my mind. So.
Yeah. But in, you know, adversely, the negative ones probably are more influential on a different type of person, like different type of person to a Matt Templeton. Like I've had people that come in and yell and scream and all that sort of stuff. And I know that I don't react very well to that. Like I'm not going to follow that person. Whereas some people love that.
Yeah, I know that I'm a, am not a, I don't react to people yelling and things. I actually get calmer and quieter.
Right.
And which I think actually annoys them even more. So, take the scenario of a high tempo situation where there's lots going on and someone's running around yelling at everyone to do things faster and do that better. And you sort of just like, yeah, okay, cool. Why don't we all just calm down for a second and we'll get it. Like, you know, the ship's not going to turn around any faster, no matter how much you yell. So, and that's certainly where I've probably got myself into trouble a few times because don't react to that sort of thing. And people, find that, maybe a little bit, like I'm undermining them or something like that.
Yeah, so. And I think that's one of the biggest things with leadership is realizing the people that you're trying to lead and how different people react to different types of instruction, for example. And not everyone's going to react to, you know, I guess urgency where urgency is due, but there's different ways to deliver urgency as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think delegation is probably the key to all of that. Like, you know, if you can have everyone spun up such that when something happens, everyone knows their job and off they go and they feel empowered. That's sort of, I think the best way to do it. Comes back to your sort of statement about micromanagement. It's a terrible, terrible thing. I'm a big fan of delegation. I'm a big fan of giving people responsibility and saying, "Yeah, you run with it." And I tell you what, I'll be here. And if you're about to do something really, really bad, I'll stop you. But otherwise, just do your way. You know, like, and if you stuff up, doesn't matter. Like, you know, as long as we don't put a ship aground or lose $1 million or have a massive security breach, it's like, what's the worst can happen? Like, we just have to do it again.
Slightly switching topics. What do you think happened in the Suez Canal recently? Yeah,
that's interesting. I've sort of only read obviously the same media reports that anyone else has read, but it just looks like one of those classic sort of layers of things probably coming on. So
it was a dust storm at the time, is that?
Yeah,
did you hear
I think dust storm, so visibility. So you know, probably got away from the center of the channel. Big ship, really big ship. Really, I'm not sure if there was a power failure or something like that, but big ships in really narrow waterways have really interesting physics around them, the fluid dynamics, and it doesn't take much to be very comfortably in the center of a channel, and then all of a sudden you just get sucked off to one side. And once that happens, it's sort of like, you know, when you put your tires into a puddle on the freeway, the whole car just goes. I think it's just one of those things. That's what we spend most of our time, I think, training for that moment when something like that happens. And
these people have pilots that, you know, pilot these big ships and do it daily, right? So it's not like it was inexperience or anything like that. It's
just one of those things. Things just layer up. I mean, probably and I'm not suggesting this is what obviously happen there, but probably the biggest risk in any really professional organization I found is complacency. Mm-hmm. So I've done it 100 times.
Right.
Let's just get on with it. You know, that's when, you know, in your line of work, people go, oh, we won't worry about locking or tagging that out. We'll just get it done. And you know, that's when someone gets hurt. So, but yeah, ships in particular are really complicated things. Mm. There's a lot going on. That was a pretty big ship from memory, massive sail area. So where the wind can catch it, you know, doesn't take much to, you know, you get a big gust of wind and you might get, you know, I don't know, millions of square feet of pressure on the side of a ship and it just pushes it off course. So yeah. I'm sure they'll pull it apart and figure it out, and there'll be some pretty interesting reports from
find somebody to blame.
Yeah, from AMSA or IMO on it, and and hopefully, you know, prevents it happening again.
So joining the Navy, how much of that was about leaving home? Just going back a few steps here.
Yeah, God, that's a really good question.
Yeah.
She
said you're a small town boy.
Just growing up. So I grew up on a farm. Yeah. So we're about 40, 45 minutes out of town.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, big farm, you know, small population. Leaving home? Not so sure. I think it was like the main thing I can remember is really that I just had no enthusiasm for doing 3 or 4 more years of school, you know, and for the listeners, I'm doing the inverted commas thing, school, and so this idea of just going to uni and studying something, because I had no idea what I wanted to do, should I study maths or physics or chemistry or biology or, you know, rocket engineer or, you know, an accountant, who knows?
Yeah.
And I guess, and maybe I was wrong in this perspective, but I sort of felt like that was really me choosing the rest of my life. Like if you do a degree in science, that's it. You're a scientist forever.
Well, so many people do feel that way.
Yeah. And in a way, I think, you know, I took that mentality forward because I joined the Navy and then I thought, this is it. This is my career. This is what I've chosen to be. And I'll do this until I'm 67 and then I'll retire to a small acreage holding in, you know, the south coast of New South Wales or something like that.
Right.
I think it was partly avoiding trying to make a decision in a way that I didn't want to settle. So if I just put myself in the hands of, you know, the gods, said, oh, I'm just going to join the Defence Force and I'll just do what I'm told. Great. Now I'm sort of hands off. Just follow the bouncing ball or,
We are so similar in that, you know, I never made a decision. I just do what I do now by accident. And fortunately I don't hate it. And,
I think fortunate accidents are common and they're, certainly, you know, I've never, so since the Navy, I've never really chased a job. I've never really sought out a career. Things have just sort of happened and I've sort of said yes to them. I probably should say no to a lot more things, but I tend to say yes a lot. You just sort of blunder along like, okay, I'll, you know, what next?
So, are you like me in that you're envious of those people that knew exactly what they wanted to do?
I think so. I think I'm envious of people who are passionate about things.
Mm-hmm.
Something I've sort of discovered about myself over the years is that I have short sprints of very intense interest about things, and then I might achieve a goal or I might, you know, come to a suitable endpoint and think, ah, okay, you know, what next? I'd love to be, in a way, one of these people who just always wanted to be a human rights lawyer or always wanted to be an electrician or a hairdresser or something.
Mm.
And that, you know, that they can just be so focused and so happy and so satisfied by doing that. Whereas, you know, I think if I went and did a hairdresser's apprenticeship, that would probably be really super interesting and I'd probably really quite enjoy it. you know, because I'd be committed to it, but then probably after a couple of years of going, okay, cool, I can cut hair. You know, what next? I think that's that I'm not sort of really sold on anything as a purpose in life or a meaning of life. I'm just sort of like, oh yeah, that that looks good. That looks shiny.
Yeah. Look over there.
What are that? Look, what do you do?
Paper bag.
Yeah. That's it. Like, so yeah, I mean, I wish, because what I think it will resign me to is that I'll always be sort of just introductory to a lot of things. So I'll probably never excel. I'll never be the top dog of something, because to do that, you've got to hang around for a long time, you know, to be the boss of the Defence Force, you know, 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, and even to, you know, run a successful hairdressing salon, you probably need, you know, 20 years or something like that. So I think I'll always be one of these sort of people on the fringes who pops in, learns a lot, becomes a jack of that trade, and then goes off to do the next thing.
I'm off to find something else.
Yeah.
And I guess the message, or, you know, for the listeners who are looking for some direction, is that you don't put so much pressure on yourself to find that direction. If you don't know what you want to do, you don't need to know what you want to do.
Yeah.
You know, you'll find a way.
Yeah, absolutely. Like we asked earlier, I can't really put hand on heart and say why I joined the Navy. I can tell you why eventually I left, and I can sort of tell you some of the decisions I made in between. But, you know, how I then decided to do the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, I just sort of, you know, like I said, sort of cruised along. An opportunity popped up, and I thought, oh yeah, I'll have a go at that. And the right things seem to happen at the right time. So I don't know if it's that you're more aware of it, that you're saying, oh, okay, I need a new opportunity in life, and then you actually see those things that are already on offer, or you know, sometimes you make your own luck. I think there's a lot of it, but I've never sort of been one of these people to go out and like hard sell myself to, geez, I really want to do that. I'm going to get out there and, you know, make waves. I just sort of go, oh yeah, you know, I'd really like to, you know, be a hairdresser's apprentice. And then, you know, probably tomorrow I'll sit down next to someone and they'll be, oh, I'm a hairdresser, I'm looking for an apprentice.
Right.
Oh geez, well, this is interesting, you know, and off we go. So,
a bit of luck involved throughout your career then as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, you can follow, occasionally I do for my own satisfaction, is you follow back all the decision points, the positive and the negative points that got you to where you are. And you go, God, some really awful things put me where I am today. And how grateful am I of that? You know, like if I hadn't told that senior officer what I really thought, I wouldn't have got kicked off that boat.
Right.
Was there a bit of that?
I
think there was at least once or twice I've done that. You know, if I hadn't quit that job, if that relationship hadn't failed, you know, if all those things, all those negative things hadn't happened when they happened, then some of those negative things drove decisions to do other things, which then, you know, resulted in me meeting the person that gave me my next job, or, you know, inspired me to go and do the next thing. So,
So what rank did you reach in the Navy?
So lieutenant, which is the Army equivalent of a captain.
Okay.
So it's sort of like senior lower management, if you could have that. It's pretty much the default rank that pretty much everyone can get to.
Right. So at that stage as a lieutenant, you're captaining ships?
No, so my senior role in command chain was second in command of a couple of small vessels out of here. I did executive officer of the HMAS Paluma, which is a little catamaran survey vessel out of Cairns. And then as a reservist, I've gone back and you know, temp exoed a couple of those boats as well. So that was sort of my highest position in, you know, command chain as such, like there's only like 15 people on board those ships.
Right,
so it's not hard to be pretty close to the boss.
Right.
Then probably the senior career role was, as the, senior surveyor on one of the larger hydrographic vessels. So, which is, you know, the head of the hydrographic department effectively. So, two slightly different angles, but both sort of one after the other, and sort of the top roles in my careers for sure.
Mm. So how much, just the fact that you can wear a beard in the Navy, is that, how much influence was that? I mean, can everyone wear a beard?
Everyone, yeah. Everyone, in the Navy.
In the Navy, yeah.
everyone is entitled to wear a beard. So that's got to be a huge
draw for those people who like to wear beards.
I think certainly since the late 2010s when hipsters right. got back in, our recruiting of hipsters is much higher. So
there's
higher.
A lot of coffee shops on board.
Huge amounts of coffee shops. Yeah. So, God, it probably took me 15 years before I could grow a beard that I was allowed to keep.
Because it's got to meet certain specifications, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. So you got to have good coverage. You know, you don't want any of that sort of wispy adolescent sort of beard action, or just a little mow, or just a little goatee. You just need
a manly beard.
Yeah, yeah. You have to grow a full beard, and you've got about 4 weeks' grace. To do it, so you got to
bring it into the line.
Yeah. Right. So if you're like me for the first probably 10 years and you couldn't grow a beard particularly quickly, right. you might take your annual leave and you'd stop shaving when you started your leave. So you sort of got a 4 week head start.
It's all about timing.
Yeah, and, get it out. So I think it's good. It differentiates us when we go into joint operation spaces, getting to cruise around with a beard on. I think it's quite good. And it one of the main reasons is that it saves you about 4 or 5 minutes every morning. So like if you've got to shave, you've got to get up, have a shower, have a shave, and then get to breakfast, then get to work. You literally, that's 5 more minutes in bed.
5 minutes, exactly. It's a big deal.
Yeah. And when there's only one or two basins and there's, 20 or 30 blokes lining up to have a shave, you're just like, nah, skipping that line. Yeah. Straight to breakfast. Love it. So, it's a good thing. I like it. It's a bit of identity.
So you mentioned work on a survey vessel. Did you ever fear for your life, I guess, working in the Navy?
Not really.
Combat or anything.
No. So I fortunately or disfortunately, depending on what sort of perspective or mindset I'm in, never saw any real service of that degree. Probably tried as much as I could to get to.
Oh, really?
The Second Gulf War or Iraq or Afghanistan, things like that. Basically, since I joined. Well, I joined a couple of months after 9/11. So obviously, there was a huge military focus for pretty much my entire, well, still going on. We're exiting Afghanistan as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
There's a weird sort of undertone to my career that in a 20-year defense career, I never went to any, never saw war-like service or active service.
That's not uncommon though, right? Like, well, no. Especially in the Australian military.
Yeah, I don't think it is uncommon. I think it's reasonably normal. Like, there are a lot of people that between Vietnam and sort of the Gulf Wars, like we didn't really do anything for quite a long time, sporadic peacekeeping roles. But there's a little regret there that pretty much all my peers have gone and, seen service in Afghanistan or Iraq. And that's what you
train for at the end of the day.
Yeah. And so never sort of ticked that box. However, I also understand that, there's a lot of, damage that can happen to people by attending those things. So probably I'm quite fortunate to have not. Mm. But I think there's also that little bit of, survivor's guilt that can creep in of going, but I didn't, in 50 years, tell my grandchildren, oh, no, never got involved in any of that sort of stuff, which is, like I say, probably fortunate in the long run, but there's that little adolescent childishness bit in me that goes, God, you missed out, whereas you haven't got the medals, you haven't got the stories, that sort of stuff. But, so most of my career was on sort of domestic services, so cruising around Australia. Did a few trips to outer bits of Australia, so Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, New Zealand, New Caledonia, places like that. But always in very non-warlike operations. Probably the closest I ever got was doing the runs sort of between Darwin and Christmas Island. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure what the current correct political term is, but we called them the CIEVs, so the suspected illegal entry vessels. So dealing with people coming down from Papua New Guinea, Indonesia and India and things on very unseaworthy vessels, and then the patrol boats would go and round them up and bring them onto our ship, and then we'd take them over to Christmas Island. And
so you had some involvement with that then?
Yeah. A lot of that was, it was very, very sort of passive sort of stuff. Like we just, the ship was very quiet. We had, 150 people on our flight deck type thing.
Yeah.
Normal operations of the ship were significantly changed, but I didn't have a whole lot to do with it. I basically just, stayed inside and ran the survey system and kept my hands clean.
So why did you leave?
Good question. So it was at the 10-year mark.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously
there's a
line there with 10 years, long service leave, stuff like that. So,
and what is there a requirement, like a minimum requirement, if they train you to a certain level?
So because I was direct entry, so I never went and sort of got a degree on their coin.
Okay.
I sort of had like a rough minimum service period, which was 6 years. But there was nothing really, I could just put my notice in effectively. I want out, and
they'd talk you into staying.
And then after 6 years, I went on to an open-ended contract, so I could just stay as long as I like, basically, as long as I didn't do anything particularly wrong. I sort of got to that 10-year mark, which is when I was now the senior surveyor, and I sort of had just felt that I'd reached that that peak in my career interest. So the next job would have effectively been to take command of one of the smaller vessels, which was a really big career aspiration for my entire 10 years. How do I command a vessel? Like that was the big thing. But as soon as I got really close to it, I started feeling that wasn't really something I wanted to do.
Mm.
And I don't know to what degree it was sort of self-doubt about my capability to do it. And I think so I sort of mixed that little bit of being a little bit uncomfortable with the idea of, being in total control and being actually responsible for some stuff, like real stuff, like people's lives, and a multi-million-dollar ship, sort of mixed that with also just sort of saying, oh, it's not really something I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I think because I was a little bit uncomfortable about it, and I couldn't really also see what was beyond that. So after driving a ship, where do I go? What do I do next?
Mm-hmm.
And all I could see was driving desks. So, oh, great, now you can go and get promoted and, work in Canberra or Sydney running a desk and things.
And I sort of spreadsheets and attend meetings.
Yeah, awesome. And so I sort of, I think I basically just talked myself out of it and basically just said, oh, look, I don't really see the point in doing this anymore. I was really interested in being a surveyor. I really loved that job. Hydrographic surveying for those out there. Enjoyed
it. Was that a separate course or was that just a progression in your, working your way up the chain?
Yeah, it was sort of, so you come through and you become a ship driver or an officer of the watch, which is sort of that basic maritime warfare officer qualification.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're expected to specialize. Specialize in principal warfare, clearance diving, being a MET, so weather,
surveying,
and so there was these sort of different branches, and you were expected to sort of, go up.
And that's formal kind of classroom training, or it's just on the job type stuff.
So mine was a 6-month course in Sydney,
mm-hmm.
to do my initial surveying course. So it's a CAT B international qualification. So once I'd done that, realized I loved it. It was a mixture of sort of, science and maths, mm-hmm. naval officer, ships, cruising around the Great Barrier Reef, going onto deserted islands and measuring the tide and things like that. So it was sort of like that in my mind, it was like the ultimate, you know, adventure job. Mm. But then, you know, most nights you go back to a big comfy ship, you know, have ice cream and a hot shower and right. go to bed. So, you know, the best of both worlds, I think. So I did that, went through that career progression, and then went and did a postgrad in the UK for about 8 months, I think that was. Which then
full-time training.
Yep. Yeah. So
no longer within the military though.
So sponsored by the Navy.
Okay.
But run by the University of Plymouth. Mm. Plymouth. Yeah, University of Plymouth in the UK. Which then gave me those high levels of qual that I could sign off on surveys and be mm. more competent surveyor. So sort of once I'd then gone and done the job that put all that high level skill to application, I realized that there wasn't really any more of those jobs, that the next job was to drive the ship, which is not so much to do with being the surveyor.
You'd have to stop what you actually enjoy doing and move to a position where you potentially wouldn't enjoy it.
Yeah, I think that's what I sort of, again, right. convinced myself that was the thing that, you know, I was trying to find a good reason to get out, I think.
Mm.
So I sort of decided, yep, I've done the height of my technical skill here. Mm-hmm. Everything else that defense wants me to do is just going to be admin and, you know, defensey stuff. And so I decided, now's the time to get out. And probably I could, you know, reflecting back on it, I could feel that I was becoming dissatisfied with Navy or defense. And that was my position in life. Nothing, defense didn't change. I definitely did.
Mm.
You know, I was now 27, 28. So I was like, hey, actually, I know more about life. I know more about what I want to do.
Mm.
I don't really want to be under their rules anymore. You know, I'd missed birthdays and weddings and things from being at sea. And I thought, you know what, it's time to get out and be a civilian.
And so what happened next then?
So I was looking for looking for something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And funny enough, my then commanding officer, his wife owned a chart shop in Cairns here.
Mm.
And they were leaving Cairns, so she was looking for someone to take over her shop or her business. And I thought, oh, well, I'm a surveyor and I'm a naval officer. I know charts.
I know a bit about that.
I know a bit about that. So I'll so I basically ended up buying that business.
Mm.
And then for the next currently still running, have been the owner of that business, and for probably the first 2 or 3 years worked in it full time, and then managed to start sliding myself out and replace myself with a couple of staff.
And what's the name of that shop there, Matt?
That's Cairns Charts and Maps.
Of course.
Yep. No one discount stop shop. Codes. Yeah. And that's been a really interesting like when I first pursued jumping into business, it was really about doing things my way. Mm. So, you know, for so long I'd sort of been under the, you know, the supervision, the control, the money control, the time controls, all of that of defense. And I thought, nah, I can do this better. It's, you know, I can just, if I want to buy a new computer, I'll just buy one. If I want to do this, I'll do that. So, it was really, really good. I really, really enjoyed doing it. But then after a couple of years, I sort of went, okay, I've sort of sorted this out. I know how this business works. I'm a bit bored now. What do I do next? So then I sort of started jumping back into doing a lot more defense reserve work. So going back to sea, and that also meant that it forced me to delegate shop management to my staff. Whereas again, because it was my little precious, you know, investment, I was probably less inclined to give them the responsibility that they were more than capable of handling.
Mm-hmm.
But when, you know, defense said, oh, look, we really need you to come over here and go to sea for a few months, I thought, well, you know, I'm not going to be able to run a shop from a ship at sea. So I had to, it forced me to make business decisions, which were really good ones in the end.
So why would the military do that? Why would they take a now civilian with some years of naval experience over someone who is currently enlisted?
So generally because they've run out of people.
Okay.
Or there's a gap. So a lot of the jobs I have done since leaving the full-time, so now in reserve, At sea, it's generally just filling in for somebody. So maybe someone's posted out to a new position, but they haven't, the replacement hasn't arrived. So there's a gap of
someone sick or having holidays.
Sick. Is that's the really short notice ones. Like you know, someone has a car accident, like you know, or instant, like a ship's meant to sail, but they're missing a key person. But also the posting cycle of, you know, there's different levels of demand on individuals, and so someone might have to go and do a job or a you know, a career progression course, and if they don't get that, then they, you know, miss the next job, so their career is going to be affected.
Right.
And so if they can, they'll go and do that, and they'll say, "Oh, we'll backfill it. We'll go and find a reservist to slot into that gap for a couple of weeks or a month or two."
So what for you? What are the benefits as a reservist, other than, you know, maintaining your qualification, your experience? I'm guessing maybe it pays better than what it would if you were active duty.
So reservists on reserve days, which is mostly what I do, it's tax-free dollars. That's a nice little perk.
Yeah, a benefit.
Obviously, the actual daily rate is significantly reduced, so it basically balances out that you earn the same amount of money. It just doesn't impact your taxable income.
You get paid less.
Yeah, per day I would get less, but there's no tax involved.
Gotcha.
So my take-home pay is probably the same.
The same.
So that's a good little perk, particularly if you know working other jobs. You know, you can go and earn your normal salary, and then you go and do 20 or 30 days reserve work, and, you know, that's basically, but sort of feels like cash in hand. It's not quite, but the camaraderie is a big one. Staying connected.
For sure.
You know, there's a lot of people here in Cairns who you know, I probably spent 10 years of my career around, and since leaving defence, I probably haven't seen many of them because it's just, you know, people sail on ships, people you know, post to different areas, so it's a community that you've got to be quite active in if you want to maintain it. But I also more recently have sort of started taking them as sort of working holidays, so it's a break from life as such, that you know, if you're on a ship or you're down on an army base doing other stuff, you know, they give you a bed, they give you a meal, they tell you where to be, what to do, all that sort of stuff. So you know, you're quite, you just sort of get a break from life in a way. Like,
yeah,
you
they
know,
look after you.
Yeah, and it can be quite sort of nice. And you know, there's a lot of purpose behind your time when you're there. You're busy, so you know, you're up early, you maybe go to bed late. There's a lot of people asking you questions, and you're providing information here and there. So, you know, I feel really satisfied when I get back from them. After about 2 weeks, I'm like, okay, I'm ready to go back
ready
and
to go.
Be a civilian again now. But you know, for those 2 weeks, it's a really nice break. And then you generally get home and I feel, yeah, right, now I'm gonna really get on with all those other jobs that I've sort of been putting off for 2 weeks. So yeah, I quite enjoy it. And you know, you never know what comes out of those jobs, who you meet.
It's, you know, comparing active duty Navy to being a reservist, do you get tested on your physical fitness?
So definitely as a full-timer you do. Every year you got to pass a fitness test, which is a sub-maximal fitness test, so it's not how fit you are, it's just that your, you know, body functions that you can, you know, you're not going to like really hurt yourself.
Similar to when you're sitting on an airplane, you've got to be capable to open that door if you're
in
the exit lane.
Yeah,
right?
It's actually probably not too dissimilar, actually. as a reservist, though, the rules change and they get a bit complicated depending on what you're doing. Like if you're going to go into sea time, they'll want to make sure that you're fit enough to be out there. So there's more checks. Whereas if you're just going to drive a desk for a couple of weeks, you know, they're not necessarily going to put you through, you know, your 25 push-ups or whatever you have to do. I think I'm into like the 20 push-up range because I'm so old now.
It's an age thing?
Yeah, it gets less as you get older.
So nice.
Yeah, which is good. So
I would probably only have to punch out 10, I reckon.
Yeah, it would be all on their recruiting website. Right. Tell you exactly what you got to do. It's like I said, it's sub-maximal, so you don't have to be that fit, but from, the stories I've heard. I've done a little bit of, I've helped out, you know, recruiting and stuff like that in mm-hmm. a few capacities. That, you know, it is something people fail a lot. A lot mm-hmm. of young people, you know, 16, 17, 18 year olds, that they just haven't practiced something mm-hmm. as basic as, can you do a 7.4 on a shuttle run, you know, a beep test.
Okay.
Can you do 25 push-ups? You know, mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's just one of those things. If you practice for a couple of weeks, you'll be fine. But, yeah. You know, I remember people on the day we were joining the Navy, you know, like literally, you know, pass your fitness test, get on the bus.
Mm.
You know, there were people there failing and they weren't getting on the bus. And I just thought, that's just crazy. Like, how could you not have prepared for this properly?
Do your homework effectively.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is, you know, obviously some people who you know, just can't get to that level of fitness, but obviously it's a requirement. But you know, there are plenty of people that I just thought, what do you mean you can't do that? Like, you know, what have you not been practicing? Like, you literally, yeah, is this the first time you've done it?
Yeah, surely there's a briefing that says, you know, these are going to be your expectations and the requirement you need to meet.
Yeah, and really, apart from that, and really basic aptitude, you know, maths, English, you know, like you don't have to be, you don't have to. Like I said, it's not a class-driven organization where you've got to be, you know, a member of the aristocracy to become an officer. As long as you've got the basics, you can there's a job there. You know, you can do further study while you're in there. You mm-hmm. know, if your fitness is a bit dodgy, they'll help you get through it and get up there and practice. So it's a good, I honestly, as a any young person who doesn't know what they're doing or doesn't want to make a decision, like I didn't, I think, I say, oh, well, if you've got nothing better to do, just join the Defence Force. Like the worst that can happen is you get in there and after 6 weeks you go, nah, I want out.
It's not for me.
And, you know, a family friend sort of recently did that, you know, young bloke, very capable, went down to join the army as an infantry soldier. You know, was there, gave it a go, and then after a bit just said, nah, this isn't for me. I really want to do something else. And now he's jumped across to a carpentry trade as a civvy. But, you know, like, at least he gave it a go. That's
so there is an out then, you know, you're not signing your life.
Yeah, yeah, there's endless levels of out.
Right.
both for the individual and for defence. Yeah,
okay.
You know, it doesn't suit anyone. And then there's other programs that they've got, you know, the gap year programs and... you know, for the Torres Strait Islanders and Aboriginal communities, there's sort of special recruiting paths for those, for people from remote communities and things like that, to try and get them sort of, you know, up to speed, and be it just, you know, finishing year 11 and 12 and stuff like that. So, they're quite an active organisation.
Is there a requirement, like a final school year requirement, or...?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd say year 10 would be probably the lowest.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you really want everyone to finish year 12 these days. Yeah. Like skipping out at year 10's probably not going to set yourself up for much future.
And it's probably not going to be a good reflection of your character. Yeah. So you involved yourself also. You gained an executive position with the Super Yacht Group here in Cairns.
Yes.
How did that all come about?
Again, another thing that's just sort of opportunity. So mm-hmm. when I took over the small business, there was sort of, they were already part of this organization. So I said, oh yeah, I'll continue to be part
Being
of that.
The chart shop.
Yeah. The chart shop. So, they were a member of that organization. And at the time it was just looking for some more people to help out on the board. So, it wasn't a competitive process. So I was like, put my hand up and congratulations.
You found you had the time to dedicate to that. And so,
yeah. And because I was leaving, I had just left defence, you know, I wasn't really engaged in the local community. I'd lived in Cairns for nearly 10 years and didn't really know anything about Cairns. It was literally just a place I slept when I wasn't at sea on a ship. Right. So I was looking for ways to engage with the community, business community, make networks, you know, just ground myself. So I put my hand up for that and ended up as part of the exec, which was, you know, really interesting and you know, it was a new thing for me. And then after a couple of years, stepped up to the chairman's position of it, more by name than anything. It's just a role. But again, that sort of gave me insight to, you know, some of the politics around things like charter legislation, the Great Barrier Reef management, and things like that. So, and sort of got to apply a couple of my skills in, you know, talking with politicians and writing briefs and executive summaries and things like that. So yeah, really, really enjoyable and, you know, and nice to sort of understand another aspect of the maritime space that I really didn't understand anything about before I sort of got involved. So, and
it's all about learning, isn't it?
Yeah.
Picking up some new skills there and making some contacts.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, going back to it, sort of, you know, being comfortable in not knowing what you don't know. So like there was a lot to learn and that I really didn't understand that industry. And, you know, I think it's a really important industry for our region. And certainly, you know, from a business point of view, it was good for me to support it because it, you know, the more boats that turned up, hopefully that increases the pool of people who might buy stuff off me. but also just understanding that broader maritime focus and the opportunities it gave me to do a little bit of travel and talk to some other, you know, pretty worldly people who run, you know, really large organizations you know, you never know in the future which one of those I might run into and who might have a job and who might need something you know, vice versa. And so, yeah.
Like we said, all about making your own luck, isn't it?
I really think so. And just tempering how many things you say yes to. After a while, when I exited that working for those guys, it was I'd sort of said yes to too many things, and then you have to start making some of those. Sort of they feel a bit difficult, but you've got to say, hey, look, I can't keep doing this. I got you know, six other jobs, and this is a volunteer one. I've probably got to go and do other things. So. And you know, as always, people are always really, really good about that. They don't sort of begrudge that you've got other things in life to deal with. But, you know, that was one of those times where I had to sort of say, oh, okay, you know, like, you know, I gotta say no to something and get ready for the blowback. And there is none because everyone's like, yeah,
no, understanding.
It's cool. Yeah, it's cool. Like, yeah, you got a job. No worries.
Cool. You're continuing with the reservist activity as part of the Defence Force. But in addition to that, you're doing consultancy now, Defence Force consultancy.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. So basically through a series of events, I ended up working with a bloke on a defence job, actually. One of those sort of, you know, time and place sort of moments and then got invited to come and work on a defense, a response to a tender. So, you know, really short version of that is that, you know, the government wants to buy, you know, a new ship. They put out a request for quote, effectively, you know, like, hey, anyone who builds ships, you know, send us your best offer and we'll pick one. The same way that you'd get, you know, three quotes to get a driveway put in.
So what sort of capabilities would be required of this ship, or was it more a surveillance vessel? Or
So it wasn't actually a ship. It was a bit more weird than that. But a ship's a nice, easy object to sort of talk about. But so they'd put out in terms of doing the tender, they'd define everything. You know, the color, the length, the weight, or maybe not that specific. But so it's a really large part of sort of defense procurement to go through these tender processes. You know, we're spending billions of Australian taxpayers' money on buying ships and aircraft and vessels and everything down to, you know, the uniforms and things like that. So it's quite a big thing. And that's our defense industry. So, you know, the Rheinmetalls, the Hanwas, the BAEs, you know, Adelaide Submarine Corporation, Austal. That's how these guys win contracts, is that they have to bid for them. So through a fortunate meeting, I got asked if I'd come and help a company respond to a tender, which hasn't been announced yet. That's 2 years later. That's how long this stuff takes. two years later, we still don't know if they've won or not. And that got me sort of introduced to a company that I then ended up taking over and running their operations for. So,
so what's, say, the core activities of that company?
Yeah, so the core activity is for, we approach or we work with defense industry. So, mm-hmm. you know, the big military manufacturers of the world and suppliers to basically write their tender responses and their bids for them or with them. So a lot of the time, you know, you pick company A, it's a boat building company. It really knows how to build boats. It really knows what it's doing in all that respect. But responding to a procurement document is sort of not in its area of expertise. So the company I've been working for, that's our expertise is putting teams together that know how to read defense procurement, how to respond to it, and how to interpret the you know the shipbuilding company's solution and write it in a way that you know when the government reads it they go, oh yeah, these are the guys that we want to build this next ship. So I started by actually being one of the members on the team doing the writing. So tapping into my defense experience and
your capacity as a subject matter expert.
Yeah. So a bit of subject matter expert, bit of really understanding what the problem was. So why is this needed? And what is this going to do for the soldier or the sailor, you know, that sort of stuff, and understanding the problem and sort of conveying that back to the you know, the people making the tender, so the company doing the building, and sort of, you know, trying to shape their thinking a little bit. But then also just my ability to churn out sort of government English. So not necessarily good English, but English in the way that, you know, people in government read it and go, oh, yeah, this is a well-written plan, or this is get to the point type writing.
It's a skill in and of itself, isn't it?
Yeah, and I would say I'm not a particularly great user of the English language in the written form. Certainly my bosses are far better at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could get stuff done. So that's how I sort of entered that line of work. And then after a couple of months of working on this single project, they then said, oh, actually, we need somebody to sort of oversee all of our projects. So with my background in defense and particularly sort of around operations management and coordinating things like planning and executing a hydrographic survey, I sort of took that skill and applied it to a commercial organization. So yeah, for sort of the last 18 months or so, I've been you know building the teams, executing the projects, managing the budgets, you know, dealing with all the problems that come with humans and commercial agreements all at the same time. And it's quite a dynamic little environment, you know, because, you know, generally a lot of money at stake. You know, these are generally big procurements. But at the same time, we don't necessarily know when they're going to actually submit, like release the tender. And we can't start our job until the tender is released.
Right.
So there's a lot of hurry up and wait. So I'll have a team put together of mix of employees and contractors and other subject matter experts, and we'll all be in furious agreement that it's going to start on 1 June.
Mm.
1 June rolls around and there's no job. And so then there's a lot of sitting there going, well, how long can we keep this team together? And, you know, negotiating with the client, sort of saying, look, you know, we're still here, but if this goes on for more than a couple of weeks, you know, that person's going to go and get another job. And,
That's right. You know,
I'm going to have to release these people. So it's, quite a lot of dynamics involved. But a really, really enjoyable and challenging job and huge insight to the broader workings of defense and defense industry
and in saying that, if you didn't have that defense experience, you know, you wouldn't have been approached to do this kind of work, right?
Yeah, well, I certainly wouldn't have had any kudos, I guess, amongst people, being able to walk in there and say, oh, yeah, I've been doing this for 15 years, these are the jobs I've done. I speak the language of defense.
Yeah.
then yeah, that really helps. But also, you know, the way that I got introduced to these people was I was on a Defence Reserve job, and the guy I was sitting next to training, sort of at the end of basically us being in each other's pockets for 2 weeks, said, "Hey, what are you doing next week?" You know, and I said, "Oh, nothing. Just going back to far North Queensland. I'm gonna, you know, sit back at my desk and mow my lawn or something like that." And he goes, "Well, actually, I got a job for you. Come with me."
Yeah.
And so that was one of those, you know, fortuitous, you know, moments of just going, "Yeah, all right."
And
so,
a bit of luck and a bit of not being a dick as well. You know, being able to relate to people, and you know, you didn't know this guy beforehand, right?
No.
And
then
had this.
He and I just walked into a tent, and I knew what I was doing, and he didn't know what he was doing, and he was a very emotionally intellectual person.
So there's a lot of personality makes your own luck, doesn't it? Makes your own experience.
Look, I say to a couple of people, anyone, like, as much as I hate it, it's all about who you know. What you know is really important. You got to be competent. You got to be a good operator. But in the end, I think it is about having your name known and know the right people, and like I said before, being sort of open and aware of when opportunities are coming your way, and being sort of mindful of them and going, "Oh yeah, I see that opportunity and I'm going to take it or I'm not going to take it." But yeah, sort of everything I've ever done, apart from, you know, that day that I walked in to the recruiting office to join the Navy, has been a connection from somebody saying, "Oh, have you met John? Have you met these people?" And then also not forcing things. So not being too aggressive about, you know, wanting a job. So, you know, I knew this guy I was sitting next to was in defense industry, and he sounded like he knew what he was doing, and it sounded really interesting. But you know, I just sort of left it and just let him approach me.
Yeah.
I think probably if he hadn't approached me, maybe a couple of days later after we'd gone out separate ways back home, I might have hit him up via email and say, "Oh, look, I was really interested in what you're talking about," you know. You know, but trying not to put him in a position of maybe feeling uncomfortable that you know, just because I've spent 2 weeks with him, you know, that we're now best friends and he's got to give me a job.
Yeah.
So sort of that sort of balance of you know, I think relationship over maintaining the relationship is probably the more important thing. And
that's right.
You know, and as I've exited various lines of work, I, you know, sometimes you do sort of feel like you'd like to, you know, light a match and let it all burn behind you. But, you know, that's certainly something I strongly fight the urge to do sometimes, because you know that, you know, in a couple of months, one of those people might be just the person you want to be able to talk to.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
So importance of not burning bridges and not trying to be a salesman to people, I guess. No.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. I say that the, you know, the right things, sort of come easily. Not to say that they're easy to do, but they're just easy decisions to make. So, you know, joining the Navy was an easy decision. Buying the business was an easy decision. You know, accepting this work as a operations in a consultancy, they were just easy decisions. Like, I didn't even have to think about them. I didn't weigh them up and, you know, do pros and cons and, you know, some complicated matrix. It was just, yeah, that sounds great. Yeah, let's do it. and so that's sort of how I've, in a way, driven my decision making, is that the right things feel right and they're easy. Whereas as soon as you have to start pros and cons and do I really want to do that? And, oh, but you know, then I'll miss out on the footy training. You know, you start talking yourself out of it.
Yeah.
Well, that's the decision already made. And,
yeah.
And there's, I think there's the, I'm not sure who said it or who, you know, originally coined it, but you know, that idea of, you know, if you've got a decision to make, flick a coin and, you know, heads, yes, tails, no. Well, your gut will tell you which way you want the coin to land. So you don't even need to know what the coin does.
You don't need
it's
the
just
coin.
Like, oh God, I hope this is a head. It's like, oh, that's it. You that's don't, it. Decision that's it. Made. Decision made. So, so yeah, I've sort of tried to take that mentality a little bit forward. And again, that probably took me, you know, 10, 15 years to sort of start feeling comfortable that, hey, actually I know what I'm doing. I know who I am and I know, what works for me and what doesn't work for me, and also being able to express that to other people, and sort of say, you know, and not be concerned about disappointing somebody, like, oh, you know, you're leaving this brilliant 10-year Navy career, like, you could have kept going all the ways. Yeah, could have, but I didn't want to. And being confident and comfortable being able to say that, you know, and then the same in all aspects of life, you know, you know, being able to turn down a car salesman saying, oh, it's a lovely car, but it's not for me. You know, you don't have to say yes.
Yeah, exactly. And that all comes with experience and, you know, age and
absolutely
stuff.
And it is literally only something you can learn you know, I think practice at saying no and being comfortable in the way that you in the decisions you make is really really something we sort of lack sometimes. I think there's a level of resilience around that where, you know, one, bad things happen, it's okay, it's not the end of the world, and then two, sometimes you make crappy decisions or you make decisions for the wrong reasons. It's okay, like, let's get on with it.
So we spoke a little while ago and you were authoring a book or a book of charts, was it?
Oh yeah. So
did that go ahead?
So so myself and one of my long-term employees, there was a small gap in the market. Obviously we're in the chart and map business and deal with a lot of, you know, small yachts and cruise ships and things like that. There was a little gap in the market for a book that sort of described safe anchorages between Cairns and Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
There'd been some previous iterations of that book, you know, they sort of fallen away. So we thought, oh well, you know, I know boats and I know charts, and he had 40 years at sea as a trawler captain up around you know, far north Queensland and the Northern Territory. So between the two of us, we just went through our notes and said, well, we can do this. So basically ended up self-publishing that, and now sell a few copies.
So people can get that.
Yeah, we just got it at the shop, or people like Whitworths and stuff like that. So some of the other retailers have taken it on. It's a very, very small market. We don't do too many, but
if people want it, they can come see you and get one. Yeah.
If you're taking a yacht between Cairns and Darwin, you know, it's just a handy. There's handy, like, there's obviously lots of information, but a lot of the time, and it's probably the same for people who go four-wheel driving. You know, it's the layers of information. You know, you're getting positive reinforcement on certain pieces of information, and you know, different people, different experiences. So so we do that, and that's sort of just a bit of fun. I think it took me 6 months to pull it together, and probably sold a couple hundred copies over the years. But
killing it.
You know, it's one of those things. I think my staff have the most fun when he gets to autograph it in the back. You know, I think he genuinely enjoys that. So if you want a copy,
that's the small things.
Yeah, get in there and make sure you ask for an autograph.
And get an autographed copy. So with all your experience and all your different lines of work, and, you know, your constant changing and reinventing yourself, do you have any horror stories? Any worst case scenario, bad worst day on the job type stories?
Yeah, I've got lots. I was actually thinking about this driving here. What's my horror story? And the funny thing is, I can't really remember most of the details, but I remember the feeling coming out of it, and generally rage or frustration or something like that. But I think a lot of them are actually just being, like, insanely disappointed in myself, like how poorly I executed something or reacted to something.
Mm-hmm.
Funny enough, none are horror stories about staff or people working for me and things like that. It's all very me, in my mind. But I do remember this, it was the day that basically ended my sort of fast ship, you know, war fighting career. And then I came up to become a surveyor. And we were out there in the, you know, the big blue Jorgen off Sydney and ships going everywhere. You know, felt like there was 100 ships there. There was probably five.
Right. You know. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there was enough going on. And I just remember at some point in all of that, that, you know, we're breaking away from this, whatever, you know, organization of ships and just like literally having no idea what I was doing all of a sudden. And then, you know, basically being someone coming up and saying, hey, look, boss wants to talk to you on the bridge wing. I'll take the watch, which is just a bizarre thing to have happen in the middle of your 4 hour, you know, watch. And then standing on the bridge wing and I think the navigator and the boss just going, what's going on? Mm. And I went, I don't know. He goes like, that was a disaster. And I was like, yeah, well, what would you have done different? I said, I don't know. I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. Like just completely, completely lost.
Just overloaded, maybe too much going on.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
And knowing your limits. Eh?
Yeah. And then the brain just sort of going,
yeah,
you don't know what you're doing anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah, we got like back alongside, I think the next day, and then I stepped off that ship, never to step back on it.
Mm.
So that in itself was a, like, there was a lot of things that probably built up to that. But yeah, it was just that day of realizing that, Jesus, you know, for 2 years of full on training, I honestly couldn't comprehend what my job was that day. And I don't remember anything particularly bad happening or anything particularly good happening. I just definitely remember being out on that bridge wing and having that conversation and going, yeah, I really have no idea what I'm doing anymore. I've literally dropped all my knowledge and all my experience. You know, probably a day later, having had a good sleep and you know, a good feed, I probably could have got back up there and got back on it. But, you know, the situation was thus that wasn't an opportunity that was going to be presented. So I certainly remember that day. But I think, as I said earlier, you know, that decision led to a whole lot of then other things happening, which, you know, ultimately leaves me sitting here talking to you, and you know, I'm pretty happy with that outcome. So it probably felt pretty crap at the time, and I know I was extraordinarily sort of embarrassed and distressed about how this would look, you know, like what's this guy done to his career? But then I also realized that the Navy or the Defense Forces, an organization, doesn't have a memory. Individuals have memories, so there might be some individuals out there that might not like me or might remember that I was a bit crap some aspect of my job, you know, now 20 years ago. Yeah. And it's really only me that's holding on to that.
Yeah.
That most of them probably don't remember.
Yeah.
The organization doesn't remember.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a problem for me to deal with. And for the most part, I just go, oh yeah. Yeah. Well, it was just a good lesson. Away. Yeah. Let it go and roll on.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. That's about it. And there's a few other sort of similar circumstances of, you know, just having bad days. You know, but I think if you bad days, everyone has them. And that if you've got those good relationships around you, you know, people will accept you have a bad day. You might say some awful things. You might do some really dumb things. But then, you know, they'll still grab you at the end of the day and say, you know, hey, you want to come and have a brew? Or do you want to watch a movie? Things like that. And you can sort of go, oh yeah, cool, right. That was work. That was a bad day. These are actually humans. This is you know, that sort of stuff. So I think, there's a few adventures there.
If, you know, going by our discussion and your constant need to reinvent yourself, is there a dream job? Would you say you're doing it because you just, you know, follow everything that interests you, or would you prefer to be a carpenter or an electrician?
I think going back, I wish I could just be one thing. That'd be really handy.
Just one thing.
Just one thing. Work about 20 hours a week, and then spend the rest of my time on a small holdings farm. You know, mowing the lawn or something. I really don't know. I know that what I enjoy and what I'm good at is creating things and problem solving. So, you know, taking passionate ideas and helping people with those.
Right.
which is, you know, sort of why I really enjoyed operations, because it's taking the problems of a business and finding a way to deliver those and make them real. So I think my dream job is really anything that involves other excited and passionate people. I'm a bit of a logical, pragmatic type.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mix really well with people who are enthusiastic and excitable and you know, who need to sort of be dampened by, you know, someone like me that sort of said, whoa, let's think about the practicalities here.
Hold
for a second.
Up there,
yeah. Well, so yeah, I think I really enjoy being in that sort of right-hand man role.
Mm.
So being somebody that, you know, someone turns around to and goes, oh, what's, you know, how are we going to get through this? Just leave it with me. I'll have a think about it.
Mm.
I quite enjoy that. And then delivering a solution and hopefully that solution goes well. And then I just sort of, you know, disappear into the background again and you know, let someone else deal with all the fanfare up front. that's what I enjoy. And so I think there's a lot of demand for someone like that, and I've just got to find the next person or people or organization I want to work with.
Yeah, not so much someone that seeks accolades and being recognized. You're just happy being one of the worker bees, eh?
Happen. I think I swing between the two. You know, people like accolades, mm-hmm. but you know, I think a good bit of positive reinforcement from those around you is sometimes all you need. Like, yeah. Oh, geez, that's really helpful. Thanks. You've done a great job. That sort of stuff. As opposed to, you know, not hearing anything for 12 months and then receiving a certificate like that doesn't really excite me. But yeah, a bit of recognition is obviously of value, but, ultimately the recognition I think I would always seek is from those people that I'm sort of trying to serve up to, of, you know, they've got a problem, they can't solve it, I can.
Yeah.
And, you know, one, seeing that problem solved brings me a lot of, you know, pleasure and joy. And then two, them acknowledging that, you know, they couldn't have done it, but I've done it. That makes me happy. Because I know there's a lot of things that other people do that I can't do.
Yeah.
So, you know, and hopefully, you know, I can reciprocate that sort of, you know, appreciation.
Any advice for your 20-year-old self?
Don't be so focused on any one thing so hard. I think I went too hard too early. In the Navy career.
Okay.
Don't think I've had good balance back then. I think I'm still trying to find balance.
Mm.
I think I sort of swing between, you know, full throttle career and then, you know, completely off the pedal lifestyle. So,
fair enough.
which can be trying and testing for all those around me. I think find more balance earlier. Yeah. You know, have a hobby, commit time to doing things that are not to do with careers or work or money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keep rock climbing. There's a good example.
And you still run? You're a running man.
Try to run.
Not competitively.
Not competitively. No, God. I'd like to. It's one of those things that it's a sport you can take anywhere with you.
Mm.
You just need a pair of shoes, or you don't even need that sometimes. And it's quite, you know, mindful. I think it's in your own space, in your own head, and you set yourself a goal and off you go. I try to run.
And you've just finished a 2-year contract with the consultancy, as we mentioned earlier.
Yep.
So what's next, man? How do you find more work? For one, I'm guessing it comes to you a lot of the time, but what are the plans?
I think it will. So there's no plan as such. I think something will come to me as such, but I don't want to say it in the sense that, you know, people are banging on the door. I think the right time, right place, something will pop up that works for me. I've got a bit of defense reserve work lined up, so that you know, keeps me busy and allows me to travel, which I enjoy. So I'll get to go and hang out in some interesting places. I've got a bit of a plan to just, you know, float around the country for a little bit. I can't leave the country. You know, I'm pretty keen to get into Central Australia. And I've got some friends, or obviously friends distributed around the country that I should probably go and visit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think around that, you know, the right opportunity will present itself, and I'll jump on it. I mean, I've still got the shop to manage, still got the defense reserve work to manage. I think I've got a large network now in the defense industry space. So, I think there's enough there. I think I'm going to swing into the lifestyle zone for a couple of months, and just sort of see what happens and be cool and comfortable, not earning and not chasing a job, wake up in the morning, do some yoga or something listen to the birds.
It sounds to me like you've got a real good handle on this work-life balance, and I think you're fortunate in a way in that the reservist work that you get gives you that, like you said earlier, a working holiday option, which sounds awesome to me. Like you just kind of go away, check out a life for a bit and go somewhere new and hang out in the camaraderie with colleagues and doing something you enjoy. It sounds awesome.
Yeah, and I think the best part for me is that it's got a fixed end date. So it's 2 weeks.
Yes.
You just you zone in for 2 weeks and then you're done and you go from there. So yeah, still working on work life balance, as in both happening simultaneously. I'm very much one or the other. Mm. I have work or I have life. Trying to find that and try and find that sweet middle spot. And, you know, and it could be that I just have to be one of these people in the future that goes and works intensely for 3 months on a contract and then I take 3 months off and then I work like that. So, you know, sort of similar to your, you know, FIFO sort of situation. I've just got to be just trying to zone in on that. And you also never know what's coming around the corner. Like, you know, in life, in relationships, in work, you know, global pandemic situations. Yeah. So we'll just play it pretty flexible, play it loose and see where we end up.
Awesome. Matt, thank you so much for coming along, mate.
Thank you, John. It's been really nice.
It's been great to see you again. And we'll put some, maybe the website up for the shop.
Yep.
On the contact details, and people can
organize. LinkedIn's some. About the only way to get me. I don't do social media.
Yeah, fair but, enough.
People are more than like welcome to hit me up, and I'll try and respond if I can.
Matt Templeton, thanks.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, brother. Talk again soon.
Cheers.
All of the music on this podcast is written, recorded, performed, and produced by yours truly. If you like what you hear, you can find most tracks at my SoundCloud at varying degrees of production. Details in the podcast info. If you're a singer and interested in providing some vocals for any of the tracks without vocals, hit me up, and who knows, you may feature on the podcast. Also, if you've got any suggestions or requests for a career which you would like me to cover, drop me a line, either on the Working Class Instagram or Facebook page. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes. Take care and stay motivated.
Big shout out to Matt Templeton for today's episode. Today's track is called The Plumber. Enjoy.